Siddharth, how are you, my man?
How's it going?
Good, good. Welcome
Thank
to the
you.
show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we always like to start, where are you in the world and what's it like there today?
I'm on the other side of the world and I'm in Dubai right now. We just passed the hottest summer and now we are entering winter, so it's just more started getting more pleasant where you can start work, walking out or maybe go for a jog finally.
So I was just there a couple of weeks ago, and like there were multiple people that had just moved to Dubai in the Web3 space, like that week that I know. And I was like, there's just multiple people moving there. I mean, what's it like on the ground there with from like a, you know, just an industry, like you got conferences, you've got meetups, you've got everything going on. I mean, what's it like being there?
I think most important, obviously, suddenly you have a place to meet really top guys from the crypto industry. It's something that was missing for a long time. From a very regulatory point of view, there's a lot of listening in terms of how to sort of nurture this new industry. Obviously, a lot of things have still not been figured out, but I love the at least the interest in terms of setting this up and really looking forward to that. Especially what we are building, it's a very global product in the gaming space, and you have a lot of encouragement right here in terms of how the gaming market works as well as the crypto space. More so, I think meeting like-minded people is fantastic. I think that's something that gives me high.
Yeah, you've been in this space a while. I mean, you want to just walk us through a little bit about your career in Web3 and maybe even before that and how you got started?
So I think I've been an entrepreneur since all my life. So that's almost 18 years. I started my first company while I was in college and I took a lot of, sort of drop off and then finish my college later. Maybe in 2013, we used to have this college professor used to come to our office and he used to talk about Bitcoin. And he said, this is Bitcoin. Do you know it's money out of thin air? And I used to never believe him. I used to like literally debate over him, like saying, how is that possible? Like, if anybody can do it, then that's not money. Then he told me that, do you even know he asked me this question, do you even know how money works, the concept of money? It's all belief system. Over the years, I started learning a lot about it, started just reading about it more passively. 2013, I think 2014 or 15, I started buying Bitcoins when it was just above or below $100. I'm a DIY guy, so I love to do mining. So I started set up a small mining rig. Over the years, things started evolving, right? And we were building another product called as CrowdFi. CrowdFi was world's biggest social media marketing tool. And in that whole thing, what was happening was a lot of people were able to market themselves and grow their social media accounts, not by spending on ads. And sort of we reached a stage where we became a competitor to the ad unit of Twitter and Facebook. And they did not like us, right? And they said, hey, you guys are doing this. We need to restrict your API and things around it. That's when things got more, we got more aggressive saying, hey, this is centralization. How they can cherry pick us and say, hey, this is not allowed. And that's where this was 2017. And that's where the moment of decentralization was starting off. Me and my co-founder, we were just talking about it, like say, hey, we need to build something that is not controlled by these guys. We need to build something around it. We started building our first project in 2017. This was more like, more decentralized content creation for these influencers and everybody to create content. Obviously, it did not work out because we realized that infrastructure is not ready yet. While we were in India, we said, hey, you know what? Even in India, people are not able to access this revolution that is happening. Most of the exchanges that was there, they were not that evolved. They were not high quality right there. So we said, hey, there's an opportunity to sort of build it out. And I think that would give us access to the whole Web3 revolution. And that's what we did in 2017. It took us 3 months to build. And that was WazirX. We built WazirX. WazirX is India's crypto exchange, the largest crypto exchange. The day we launched, within 30 days, there was the RBI ban. RBI is more like federal bank. So RBI said, hey, there's a crypto ban, banking ban on any crypto businesses. And there we are. That we lost our bank account. We lost everything. And we were like, hey, what do we do? Should we just shut down WazirX because it's just been 30 days? Or should we literally fight over this, right? Literally fight against everything. And somehow we decided to do that. And we literally innovated ourselves. We built a P2P exchange, which sort of bypassed banks. People could buy and sell crypto without using our bank account. Over a year's time, we became the number one liquidity provider and also became number one. And we were also fighting this in Supreme Court as an industry. And I think by 2021 is where we sort of won that case. and everything changed. Suddenly in 2020, like we had the case that was being, you know, fought for almost 2 to 3 years, and we won that case. And we said, hey, now we have banking support, and crypto exploded in India like nothing. And also in 2018, I've been investing into games because I genuinely believe that games are the next big thing for crypto. It's just perfect match, right? You know, one way where you're trying to sell what is Bitcoin, you have to teach people how money works. The other side is like, you know, what is Ethereum? Teach people how cloud computing works. And then DeFi, forget about it, right? You can't even explain to people how DeFi works. But when it comes to gaming assets or gaming things, people do understand, because even before crypto, even my mom, who used to play games, and she knows what's digital asset. And it was just there. People just understood it. It's just that, you know, it just was so perfect that I had to get in. And 2018, I was just getting involved, investing into games and, you know, trying to do this. And probably around, you know, end of 2018-19 is where I lost all the money. And I realized, hey, you know, it's when you lose your money is when you suddenly do your research, you know, what happened. And that's when I started researching, trying to figure out what happened, right? Like, why did I lose my money? And going deeper into this games, and I realized that, you know, these games, though, have a playable model, but they are very weak at economics, especially open economy, because they're more borrowing a Web2 economy to Web3, which is completely different, because Web3 economy is very open. And because I understood markets, I was able to bring a lot more, you know, learnings to that and sort of convince few games to rebuild their economy. And luckily, you know, during bear market, those games were running still fine. They do very well even today. So that was my learning into gaming. And then it opened up another Pandora box saying, hey, this is just the beginning. It's going to be really big, because game assets are more like commodity. Today, it's not there yet because the economics are not sustainable yet. It's just about a few more months or years where things will get settled in. Where if this happens, it's going to be really big.
When you said that there was an opportunity to build out Wazir X, that seems pretty brave to me. Because I remember back then when it came out, there'd be a different headline every other week or month. India bans cryptocurrency. Oh, wait, no, they don't. I'd like to know, you know, what was that opportunity like and what was that environment like? How did you guys work through that?
The banking ban happened. I completely remember that day because all our team, right, they were literally looking at us, what's next? Right, because there they are, like 3 months, you know, looking forward to what we have been. We've been talking about crypto is next, and ta-da, you know, you have this banking ban. It was very difficult. But then we took that decision, right? I don't know, it was just, you know, me and my co-founder, we probably finished a pack of cigarette, and then we're like, and somewhere we said, let's fight it, right? We were like, what do we do? And somewhere in that, let's fight it. And even I agreed to him. And we just, let's do it. We'll figure something out, right? And that's, I locked myself in a room, not the same day, maybe next couple of days, and try to figure out different models to solve this. And that's how we built world's first auto order matching P2P engine, which made it much more easier for people to buy and sell crypto without a bank account. That was completely revolutionary, and that sort of did that. To add to that, right, this opportunity was the India opportunity in general, because we could see the India coming to, you know, it's a big, big population. A lot of, you know, builders out there, like a lot of techies out there. There's going to be a lot of revolution that's happening. And how do we connect that to the world? And to me, it felt like, hey, you know, we missed out on the internet revolution, India. I felt like probably this is one chance where we can sort of, you know, get into the Web3 revolution. And that was the intent there. And you know, that I know the journey was very bad during this. I call it the dark ages for crypto in India. Because, you know, you go to any investors, you try to raise money, everybody says, hey, no India, right? So there was no way to even raise money. Everything was bootstrapped. We were literally trying to see how do we make sure that we are still able to continue and pay salaries and everything. And also, because being in crypto, our bank accounts were also frozen, right? For some of our employees, it was really bad time. I mean, when I think about it, I don't know how we got out of it, but it was a crazy time in general. But I'm very happy to have that team who literally believed in us, and you can't do it without them, right? And I think it just paid off really well.
What would your advice be to an entrepreneur who's about to have their pack of cigarettes with their co-founder moment, and they're like backed into a corner, and it's like fight or die?
I have gone through multiple debts to tell you that it feels like it's done. But it's not done. I think if you don't believe in yourself, then who else will believe in you, right? Like, that's the most important thing. And when you're working with a co-founder, I think the most important thing is we have to believe in both of us, And somewhere I believed in what he believed, and he also, you know, we sort of resonated that, because getting that alignment right is the most important thing. You know, in startup, you can raise fund, you can do everything, you have the best business model, everything. But if you don't have a great team, you know, it's just difficult. And I think I feel it's more about being lucky there. But I guess, you know, getting those things together was the thing. So if you are stuck today in these things, be very open about it. Talk about everything bad that can happen. And then ask yourself, what if it works? And once you're done with all the bad things, right, and you don't have anything to more talk about, when you talk about this, and if you do, both of you agree that it's worth the fight, I think that's pretty much it, right? Like, that's the answer right there.
In all of our time in crypto, it's like there's been these bear markets that are nearly like exclusive to crypto. It's not like, you know, Main Street has moved at the exact same like pace when there's a crypto bear market. Now we're seeing like global markets are down, crypto's down, nowhere to escape technically. That is really important advice to founders that are probably having difficult time raising. Being brave, I'll say, is important right now.
It's a very wrong, also for a lot of founders, right? I do advise a lot of folks there. And a lot of them say, hey, no, this time is different, you know, because you have the global thing. But to be very frank, for us, it's more micro that affects us. You know, it's bear market is bear market, right? It's just going to be very difficult. I think that's where the real innovation also comes in, right? When you are literally stuck in that corner and trying to say, what do I do? You know, you have, you know, very little runway. So you just focus on the thing that is needed, you know, the prioritization. Instead of just, you know, throwing money, now you're thinking about twice when you're very young. And that efficiency becomes part of your culture, which helps you scale, you know, much later. I can say I love bear market. Obviously, I hope, you know, it doesn't stay for too long. But I guess, you know, it literally helps everybody to sort of come together, be aligned, and focused on what they're building.
It's great advice. So let's talk about T-Girl a little bit. You know, what are you working on right now? What's getting you excited?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty excited about Web3 games in general. You know, it opens up a lot of Pandora box for a lot of people, especially from a capital market as well as the play market. Capital market, I think it's becoming a, I mean, I believe that the assets are going to become a inevitable investment class for a lot of people. I have seen that happening, like, you know, the games that have been being there since 2018, where players are starting with, you know, probably just $100, $200, and then eventually going to almost as big as 100K. And then you see these big guys coming in. They're actually not playing games. They're just investors and traders who are just betting on this, right? Like trying to figure it out where this will go. I think just combining that, all that thing together, if you have the right economics, right marketplace, this is an amazing, amazing place. So looking at that, that's where the idea of Tegro came in, right? Tegro wanted to be a place where we could attract a lot of these investors and traders, make sure more capital is coming into these markets really well. Capital is coming into more games really well. They are not literally, you know, players or gamers. They have the guys who just have capital and can deploy capital into it. And a very good analogy would be in the commodity markets. If you see, you have oil and gas being, you know, traded in the derivatives market. They are not the ones who are actually using those gas, right? They're just trading on it and putting a lot more capital, which attracts the entire, which builds out a lot of industry in between. So at Tegro, we have, you know, a bounty marketplace where people who can deploy a lot more money can simply, you know, pay people to play with their account and get all the earnings in that, right? So it's as simple as that. I just pay folks to play a certain part in my game, which creates more assets within my account, which is more valuable to me because, you know, I do believe that this game will become big over time. So you need to sort of scale that out, but I don't have the time. So this is the first aspect of it. And second, the most important one is the asset market by itself, where people can buy and sell these game assets. And these are more fungible assets. So, you know, there's higher liquidity and so that they can pour in a lot more money into it, which essentially grows the entire ecosystem. So, you know, these are two very important things, that is more capital to game assets and more players for people who don't have the time to play.
You know, we've just hit this precipice in like the world where there are economies online only, there's a different type of design that's going to be needed to build those out. There's a different way and a different speed in which those economies work. It's driven by maybe multiple different tokens that are out there, or maybe, you know, US dollars or whatever else it may be. It's almost like, is that the way that you're seeing the world a little bit, where you're like, hey, we're out ahead of designing out the way that economics work, but in a completely digital world?
Absolutely. You know, go back centuries back, we started with a village economy where the barter was okay, right? You know the other person and you can exchange stuff, and there's some favor or you know, something that you have exchanged in the past. And also governance, it's very, you know, one guy probably saying this is how we should do. Then we went to town, you know, we scaled ourselves to town, and then hey, you know, you are actually trading with strangers, that's why you need currency, right? Like we came up with gold coin or whatever that is. And then also the evolution of governance also went up. Then it became a kingdom, right? Kingdom was even bigger. Everybody sort of scaled that. Again, money, economics, everything scaled right there, a currency scale. Then came the countries, right? Where we are all talking about countries. So there are different countries across the world which now are sort of doing it. But now because of the birth of internet, you know, the countries don't exist on the internet, right? I'm talking to you guys, doesn't matter where you are. We are sharing the same space-time. And also there is economic exchanges that is happening, right? Today, internet is not just about chatting, but there's also business happening online. And this is to me, it feels like now we are evolving to a super nation, which is just beyond all boundaries, where, you know, we just exist. Doesn't matter where you belong physically. And when you're building those Lego blocks, you are building the first part saying, hey, you know, at least let's start communicating, which we did. Now we're saying, hey, let's now build up economic models, something that is native to this, which is I believe where Bitcoin and many other you know, things sort of coming, the whole Web3 revolution that is happening. And then obviously once this happens, then you also need governance. So again, you know, we are all exploring governance model, which is very, very native to this space. So I think there's a parallel evolution that is happening, you know, in the currency and the finance world, and also within the governance world. And the best part is, because of Bitcoin and the whole blockchain part, what we were able to scale trust across people, right? Now, you know, before we had to trust a king in the kingdom land, then you had to trust a government which has had a democratic government, which, you know, had XYZ things where people would trust a body. Now we are trusting a code, you know, which everybody believes cannot be changed. And I think it's an amazing evolution which is happening in general. So in this whole space, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for next 4 to 5 years where we are transitioning into this space. And to me, I think then projects comes more like a micro township, or a game becomes more of a micro township where there's economies that is happening, and you know, this trades that's going to happen. I think the metaverse is a right word in some way, whoever coined that, but in a way, if you think about it, this is how it's happening. Doesn't matter where you are, economies will evolve, governance will evolve, trust will evolve, and obviously communication is already evolving a lot.
In a world that doesn't necessarily rely on countries, why are we so excited for those countries to regulate crypto?
I think see, it's a transition, right? You think about it. This has happened before. When countries were formed from kingdom, there was a resistance. But ultimately, it's an inevitable future. It's getting bigger and bigger. Humans are evolving, and we are just keeping up with it. That's it, right? Like, so I think, to me, this is going to evolve, and countries will find a way to do this. Till then, you know, there will be a lot of ups and downs, and, you know, a lot of discussion around it. The pace at which this is evolving, it's not easy for a country to overnight change policies around this. And I completely understand. But again, you know, it doesn't make it impossible.
Crazy times. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting next decade for sure.
The countries that have identified this, even as an entrepreneur, people who probably have a more upside being in this metaverse and doing business there. I'm not talking about exchanges or things, maybe probably like freelancers who are actually getting paid online and doesn't matter where they're working from. For them, now there's an open opportunity to be where they want to be, right? And I think then the country doesn't matter for them. So now everybody's making those choices where they want to be, because ultimately they just want to be plugged in, right? Doesn't matter where they are. So I think now there's a competition in terms of where these guys would flock and you know, be together in terms of this. So I think that's where they, you know, Singapore and many other hubs are being formed. I'm not sure what would be the, you know, the end goal, but I think that's one of the reasons, Joe, I think, you know, we were just talking about before, where you saw a lot of folks from different parts of the world coming to Dubai, right? I think that's good. That could be one of the biggest motivation right there.
The other thing that's kind of interesting a little bit is like just land. There's no actual physical place that you can go that's like the sovereign Web3 area that like no country has, you know, ownership over in a way or protection in a way. It does seem interesting that like there are a couple just little barriers that are left. And unlike, I think, other revolutions that take hundreds and hundreds of years potentially, because, you know, it used to take 3 months to sail from, you know, Portugal to, you know, New York City. Now, you know, you're just interacting online so quickly that I think it's going to go faster than people expect. But I can definitely see how that's like a scary future, that there's a lot of unknowns of how it's going to happen. So I think it is healthy that it goes slower.
Yeah, I think I completely agree. Like, I think we are that generation where, at least I'm in that generation where I almost saw a black and white TV to a flat screen to, you know, your mobile phone, everything, right? It's just in one life, right? Like I'm 38 now. To even see that through, right? That is hyper fast. Like I can't imagine. Now we are talking about AI generating an entire movie or, you know, doing everything. This can't even imagine this. Like, you know, when probably I was probably even teen, right? This is just 20 years back. So I think, I mean, yes, speed is there, right? But it's what it is, right? Now, because of we are all connected together, the collaboration that is happening, the information exchange is faster. So if you think about it, very simple, like I just tell people. So when you write a letter to somebody, you basically compress thought and you just write in binary, almost thought, and then I share it. So the information that I share with you is very limited. So if I were to describe a scenic beauty and I do that on a piece of paper, you know, that's just very little. But if I give you a call and I describe that over a call, that's little more data, right? Because it's more rich data. I'll say it looks beautiful and you can probably hear my breath. You can see my excitement. There's more data. And now if I take a picture, there's a lot more data, right? Because things are being more shared, in more data. You can understand what I'm seeing. Then comes video, you know, blah, you know, you can almost see everything. You can feel it. Now, when we talk about VR, it's just there, like you're just like you are right there. So if you think about it, because of enabling of this data transfers, like the, you know, opening up this high bandwidth sharing of knowledge between each other, where we can just do it, it just makes the information share faster. It's almost like I can read your mind, what you're seeing or what you're feeling. And that just enables us to, you know, take your knowledge, your learning, and me applying again to the next level. And it's just when it goes into a loop, it just becomes a lot of innovation. You see a lot of innovation of building that is happening across.
I think that's an amazing way to think about data transfer. I mean, you know, I know we're moving a little bit away from like web. We're just talking the future now. But one thing that I can't believe has not been unlocked yet that I feel like would just change the world from like, because it's all about perspective. Right. Like, right. If you go visit another culture, you visit another country and you experience their food and the dancing and the drinks and everything else. Like, the one thing that I feel like has not been unlocked is just real time language. If I could pick up the phone or have a conversation with someone that's speaking another language, the barrier to entry to learn another language is just years and years and years of practice. There's a nuance, I feel like, to just the way that someone else is kind of speaking, the way that that language is actually being spoke. And like, there's just different inflections and everything. But if you can at least start with, I could speak English, someone else could speak Spanish, and we're having an instant conversation, I just feel like there would be so much perspective unlocked. And it's like, imagine just going out to a bar in Mexico City and bam, you could just have a conversation with anyone. Maybe, I don't know, maybe someone in Web3 can design that out and we can all pay micropayments in order to like speak or something. But I feel like there's something there that would be pretty amazing.
I'm not sure. I think I'd seen one Google project headphones, right? I don't know what happened to that now that you mentioned, where you can speak and it translates the other language to, you know, the other person, or maybe you can hear the other language, something like that. That's how it works. And that was a couple of years back. I'm pretty sure now that would have evolved. I don't know where it is now today. But what you're saying is could be just a few days, like, you know, a few months away from, you know, all these, what you're saying. I think because now if you can just imagine and get AI to paint a picture of exactly what you want.
Yeah.
I mean, this is nothing.
Yeah, I was addicted to creating those generative art AI thing for a while. Like, it's just, you just typing something in and suddenly you're like Batman on the Empire State Building with a, you know, with an airplane, et cetera. And bam, you get to see it. And like, you get to see like your vision. And it's like, suddenly everyone is like an artist in a way. Right.
And that's a very important point, right? People think that only artists are creative. See, You are able to see a lot of things, but on your problem is you can't draw this, or at least even right. I can't present it. But obviously you can see through exactly what you want, but you can't do that. But suddenly, because of tools, now everybody is able to bring that expression out, what they want to see. And I think that's just phenomenal, right? Like, if you think about it, like, now suddenly you have become an artist, or at least you can express your mind out, what you see, how you want to see. And that's just amazing.
So we're talking about a lot of disruption, right? And like how, you know, designing out economies in a, you know, I guess we could say metaverse, but just designing out economies, like, we're all kind of, this is the metaverse in a way, right? Like, we're all, it's just a flat screen, but we're talking about that. Why they, like, do you believe that gaming is the original, or it's like the fast? Because I know with like any business models, it's like gaming always kind of figures it out first. It's like, you know, they've always kind of figured stuff out. And so it's like, why focus on gaming and the economies of gaming first within Web3 when there's this entire world that's being built?
Absolutely. I think, there's a lot of trial and error that is needed, right? If you think about it, even long back, for a lot of people, when they start with computers, the first thing that they do is they start playing games versus, you know, learning Excel or, you know, Google, Gmail or anything, because it's very interactive. It's just the first adoption. And it's also very forgiving because, you know, games are supposed to be where you can fail, right? It's just as simple as that. And a lot of innovation happens there. Like, the need for more bandwidth came from gaming first because, you know, you could do multiplayer and everybody wanted a bigger, you know, line or low latency internet so that they can play more, both in terms of graphics. You know, they're obviously, you know, taking a big leap right there. So and when you think about economies in general, games always had in-game currencies. The entire concept of, you know, playing to get certain assets out, and, you know, the entire play around just in-game assets or in-game purchases existed even before crypto, right? So it's just been an evolving thing that's been always there within games. It was just within that game. You could not exit it out and sell that. I mean, some place you can, but it was not a very intuitive way of doing this. And that was and those assets were only primarily to gamify your game to achieve. So you're basically simulating a real economy, but in a very controlled game where you just, you know, Say if you're farming, then you get XYZ things, and then you get, and then, you know, finally you have a digital tomato. That's it, right? That's it. That's the gratification. You just feel that, you feel good about it. There's no value that is outside that game yet. I mean, this is how it has been evolving for so many years. But I think when it comes to this Web3 adoption, you need people who understand this really well. You know, people do understand that buying assets within games is expensive sometimes. This was, I think, 2017. I read Candy Crush, which is such a hyper casual game, did about what, 250 million in 2017 or 18, somewhere around that. And these are regular people just playing games and they're just buying in-app purchases. So they do understand. They have a digital small token as well. So when you expose them, and, you know, when you go to people and say, hey, you know what? So far you had digital land. Now, instead of buying digital, DeFi token, if I try to sell digital land, digital shoes, digital everything, people get it. They understand that. They say, hey, now I get this. And now I'm saying, hey, this is all on blockchain. Okay, it's much more easier. So the entire understanding, first of all, is much more receptive when you talk about when you present these kind of use cases. And again, like the gaming, I think the gaming world has been players have been the guys who always the early adopter into many things, whether it's streaming or anything that you talk about. A lot of internet adoption has happened there. Chats used to be more prevalent in games first before it became more, broke out into rest of the places. So I think from a Web3 revolution, you need an industry which is very open to trying these things out. Like when it comes to DeFi, you cannot try experiment things out because there's a lot of loss that can happen, right? Because it's more about financial transaction that is happening. And also on the underlying, there has to be a need for it. Like, for example, remittance is an underlying need for a DeFi to work, or a Forex is a need for a DeFi to work. So there has to be an underlying economy below it, on top of which you have these instruments that help you do derivatives and whatnot you can think about. But when it comes to games by itself has a a metaverse on its own, which objectifies and sort of gamifies the player to do XYZ things. And that creates the demand. The fun element creates the demand. The gameplay creates the demand. And that is where the economy sort of builds on top of it. So to me, I think this is a perfect match to get started with. Eventually, once we are over the gaming adoption, we will see more of social adoption coming in, more Web3 project, which is more social focused, like chatting and things around it. Something that we have seen in the past. So this is all these things, what we are saying is not just predicting the future. So you're predicting the future by looking at the past, as simple as that, right? So we have seen the evolution that's happening there, and this is the best predictable future that we can think about.
Is GameFi just almost like another term for just where, economics and how you do business is going? Oh, we do lose Joe. Okay.
Oh.
I'm sure he'll be back. How do you look at where GameFi is relative to the rest of the world?
Very importantly to understand this is one, you have the basic business layer, right? Or a basic objective that is the game itself. What is new in the whole Web3 gaming space is you're introducing two more important people, that is a trader and an investor, right? Till now, investors never used to play or get into games, right? They might invest into a studio and work on their revenue, but not on assets. Now, what has happened is because the economy has become open, where an asset can be taken out of the game and the demand can be seen by somebody who's not playing a game but believes in the future of this game and the future of these assets, that opens up another entire economy right there, which is the finance economy right on top. Very, very similar to the entire commodity market we talk about, right? Whether it's oil commodity or corn commodity, if you think about it, there's an entire market which there's an industry that needs corn and there's a demand supply right there at the bottom. But there's also a parallel economy, which is the derivative market, which trades a lot on that, based on the price of how it can go. And that suddenly, because there's a lot of capital coming in, a lot of development also goes around it. So there's a whole end-to-end cycle that it sort of spirals out, which builds the entire economy. And I think for a game, till now, it was a very isolated economy, which was just within the game because it was only the game developers who could sell. Now, what has happened is it's just an open economy where anybody can sell. There's a secondary sale that is happening. Anybody can create asset also, right? Before it was only the game company would create an asset and probably put it as $10. And somebody has to buy it. It's and they don't care what happens after that. There's no secondary market into it. But now what happens is I can create an asset by mining an asset within the game, and I can go and sell. And I can probably sell for low or high. It's up to me, right? And it's an open world. So everybody's going to figure that out. And this is where the magic is going to happen. And a lot more capital also going to come in. So I think this is pretty interesting to see how. So this is the difference between a normal gamified way, which is more about just getting people to do something, but there's a real economic upside right here if you are more serious about it.
So if you're a Web3 game developer, how should they think of Tegro and I guess how they should think of GameFi? Tell us where your vision is.
Yes, I think so at Tegro, we do a lot of things, but one of the things that we're doing, which is a little outside Tegro, which we call it Tegronomics, which is the economics for games. And this is primarily built around inspiration from a lot of things that is already happening in the real world. And we tried it, tested with few games during the bear market, last bear market, like I said, 2018-19, when I was more involved with games and sort of trying to do that. So in the gaming world, you know, gaming world has been evolved since almost 20, 30 years, or maybe more than that, 40 years. So what has happened is they have figured out how to play the right game, like what's the right mechanism. But when it comes to open economy, this is still a experiment right there, because we are still trying to figure how does an open economy and a game comes together, where it's well balanced between good gameplay as well as, you know, a good economy, which where people are not losing money. So what we are working on is, you know, trying to get as much learning and sort of make an open source framework for people to sort of work on that. A few of the things that learning is, you know, not everything has to be NFT, which is non-fungible, because when you're talking about an open or a secondary market, non-fungibility is illiquid markets. So today, a lot of people are now experiencing when they have illiquid markets or assets, they are not able to sell that assets, right? And if you buy worth $1 million, you can't sell that $1 million worth of assets. So designing your economy is very important. So starting with a liquid market, how do you design a liquid market? Over time, we have created a framework which is inspired from Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where you have the bottom type of economy, which is called as need-based economy. Need-based economy is more like, you know, food, water, everything that you get, that everybody needs, rich, poor, everybody needs. That's the bottom layer. Then comes the want-based economy. Want-based economy is, so if you remember the triangle of Maslow's hierarchy, the mid part is want-based economy, which is more utility-driven. Like, you know, good, I need a car. If I get a car, I can do, you know, travel from A to B faster. I need a house. It's good to have. It's not mandate, but if I have a house, you know, it gives me comfort. So these are the utility assets. Then comes the achievement assets, the achievement economy. Achievement economy is more like, hey, I don't want just a car. I want a Lamborghini. I don't want just a house. I want a, you know, mansion. So there is a special rarity that is attached to it, right? So there is all these three things have a different supply rate. If we had a Lamborghini being, probably manufactured like Hyundai cars, then nobody would want it, right? Like there's nothing special about it. So you need to have that rarity right there. And when you're designing economy, you have to understand that people want to get there, but, you know, these two things are also very important to run the economy. So without food and water, you don't have, or the utility, you don't progress well. So when it comes to game itself, you know, you have to identify what's your need-based economy, right? What's the basic thing that you need within the game that has to be more fungible, that everybody needs, will be very less expensive, and you need that to play the game. Second part is again, want-based, some of the assets within the game, which basically gives you extra power or extra utility, which is good to have, but not must have. And then, of course, the top part is the achievement within, which is where you have the NFT, where you have the speciality coming in, like the Lamborghinis, or, you know, maybe a special gun or special something within the game, or an achievement, which sort of shows you. So I think if you have that structure started, it at least lets you know how to design your basic supplies within the game. And then, you know, next part comes into, after the supply comes, is how much supply per day, right? Like should we have all the supply coming today, or should we have all the supply coming, you know, tomorrow, or should there be a predictability? And predictability is very important, because if an investor is putting money into it, or a trader is putting money into it, and suddenly, you know, more players come into a game and start mining a lot of assets, suddenly there's too much supply coming in, which drops the, you know, economy. So this erratic behavior which stops a confidence, which breaks the confidence of an investor. But if you see, there is a rate of supply of oil in the world, right? If the moment a new ore is found, you'll see in 2 days the price drops, even though the production has not started, but it's just the market's behaving. So the supplies have to be a little more predictable. So even when you're designing a game assets, the emission of the asset has to be very, something like what Bitcoin and Ethereum does, right? You already know how much Bitcoin will be mined after maybe 20 years from now. Why? Because it's predictable. If there is one miner, still it's same, or if it's millions of miner, it is still same, because there's something called as difficulty, which adjusts this rate of emission within the ecosystem. So I think that learning is very important. Just adopting that within game assets is very important, sort of to bring that predictability in. And of course, the most important part is, not unlike Web2 games, not everybody has to own something to play the game. In real life also, not everybody has to own a factory to produce something. You can work at a factory, right? You can work at a factory at a wage and still earn something. So not everybody has to be an investor, not everybody has to be an owner of everything. So it's a very important thing, because when the prices goes up within the assets, you will say, hey, the game doesn't work, right? Because of course a normal person cannot buy and play that. But that opens up another very important economy, which is a real world economy called a service economy. So you have the producer economy, consumer economy, and the service economy, who get paid to do work for you, right? So it's that's how companies are formed, where one guy probably puts a capital, but the rest of the guys get paid to produce more things. And it the ROI is usually delayed, right? So if you start a company, it takes probably a year to break even. But that is not the case for people who are working there, right? People who are working there, they need to get paid every month, every week, or however that works. So these are real economics that has to come together, how we can see the gaming world also evolve. And step by step, I think, and of course, last part is governance, which I think everybody understands, like how governance would also come in. But that is for later. But these are very basic things to sort of come across. And we are sort of putting this framework together on the side, trying to see if games adopt it so that they are more sustainable. We have already done that for a couple of games. Now we are trying to do this. So this is a very side thing. This is not the core of Tegro, but this is what I love to do, because to see the industry more viable and more sustainable, and actually unlock the entire economic opportunity that is for everybody else.
You just really got my wheel spinning. So thank you, because I'm sitting here thinking, like, okay, so if you launch a project and it is successful in its later stage, so you've done the majority redistribution of your tokens, your economy is not over, but it's more mature and it's successful, and so it's sort of like, well, now what? Now what are you going to do? And that whole service-based element, I hadn't really thought about it that way yet. Because I
Yes.
think we've been in such this early stage mentality with crypto.
Right.
And it's like, well, what does this look like 10 years from now? And how do you still grow? How do you still, like if you have a max supply and it's distributed and no one wants to sell because they want access to your awesome utility, what do you do? How do you keep growing? How do you keep expanding the community? Maybe it's a different paradigm of expanding that community. So that's really interesting. I really, really like that.
It's not something that you don't know. It happens in the real world, right? So it's a very inspired from real world. So what I'm saying is not something that I've made it up. It just happens. We just have to take that inspiration, say, hey, you know what? Let's not re we just have to copy that and put it here and then innovate later. So it's more about that, right? How do you just bring it here, see how it works, and then I think there'll be a better version of that in Web3 later. But to be very frank, at the base level, this is what it is needed. And at Tegro, we are basically building this service economy, enabling people who have money to actually just deploy, pay people to play with their account and mine more of them. So they are okay with the long-term ROI, but they believe in this game, and this is much more easier. And it's more like jobs for metaverse in a way. But we're just making this step by step for the games to get started with. And hopefully, see this evolve more. Now, there is no pressure for an asset or a game asset to probably be priced maybe 30x or 40x, because increasing that means people will be spending more, paying more wages to folks to play with their assets, and so that this economy still works. Like if you see in real world, Guild sort of did that in a way, where they bought the assets and paid people, or shared revenue with the players, and then sort of do that. But I think that's a very early sign of how this works. We have to think about how billions of people do this, right? Rather than just few thousands of people.
So, Siddharth, we could talk about, early stage games. Like in any nascent, industry, there's always like the innovation and like it's starting. So we could talk about like our friend Cheryl at Crop Bites, right? Like this new game, like, you know, thanks Cheryl for introducing us. And then they're coming up and they are starting kind of Web3 oriented, right? But then you've got things that are more mature, like, you know, you've got Fortnite, right? And like, yes, I would love to, you know, I don't play Fortnite, but I can see the value of Fortnite. And I would love if I had access to invest in some way in the economy that is Fortnite. Right. So like, how far away are we from this type of economics being injected into kind of the fire hose of games and everything else that's already out there?
The challenge that I'm seeing today is, you know, challenge I faced in 2018. I know 2018, I used to call up game studios and tell them, hey, you guys should build for Web3. You know, that time it was called blockchain gaming. And they used to literally hang up on me saying, you know, blockchain is Ponzi, blockchain is XYZ. They would not listen to me. But, you know, thank God Axie and everything else happened, because suddenly every game studio now is thinking about Web3, you know, strategy, right? They're all thinking about it. Now, another big challenge is, how do we get them to accept this economy models? Because today, again, they say, hey, you know, we have the best economists. I said, okay, fine. You know, let's talk to you. And then they come up with all these NFT and same little problem. And I tell them, hey, these are the problems. Hey, no, we still have the best guys here. So this a whole acceptance, you know, there's a friction of accepting this new model that is coming in. And I think it's more about creating that awareness in general. We are trying to create, you know, a Tegro, like a litmus paper test, Tegro litmus paper test, economic test, where we'll review certain games and show them, you know, how they score against different parameters. So that then awareness sort of comes in, right, for people to understand how economies have to be thought about, like the secondary market. Is it secondary market friendly? No, right? And if yes, okay. Is it predictable supply? Yes, you know, 10 points, and then you have a score on top of it. So when you do those sort of things, it becomes, you have to standardize it. And I think that standardization is what everybody will start accepting it. It's going to be a little tough, but I think this is like the journey for all of us. And I'm pretty sure it's not just me. There'll be a lot more people who understand these models and being able to, you know, spread this across. But like I said, if you have some knowledge, it's more important to sort of, you know, share that than keeping with yourself. To me, if we are able to bridge this gap, luckily the bear market happened. So now everybody's listening in, because, you know, just probably in last December, I was talking to a few games and telling them, guys, this, you know, Axie model will fail because it has, you know, this problem, that problem, everything. They say, hey, but everybody is doing it. Why do you want to do this, something like this? Now they are at least listening back and say, hey, you spoke about this. Let's listen in. So I think this bit of listening in happening. Hopefully few will convert. If somebody becomes a very good, you know, like a poster boy of, you know, how this has to be done, then everybody will follow. So it's more about that influence rather than just, you know, there is right information. People have to just accept it.
So, you know, here's another one for you. So some of these largest game companies in the world are public companies. They used to be like, people buy the disc and they, you know, 50, 60 bucks, they bring it home, they put it in their Xbox, digital downloads, still swiping my credit card to pay for it. Now we're saying, you're not getting any money. It's all in this Web3 economy. It's either a fungible or a non-fungible token. So goodbye to your quarterly earnings that you got used to for the past decade, two decades, three decades. Goodbye. You have to do this new model. How should they look at that?
It's very difficult, right? Like, because to even tell them what's the new business model, it's just very difficult because they're not going to think about it. I still debate a lot. Even after saying yes, you know, so they understood everything. They said, hey, and then again, go back to the game and then say, hey, you did this again. It's a very tough conversion that has to happen. And, you know, I think, you know, I've been working with Crop Bites again, you know, we've been experimenting a lot. I think they're also bringing a service economy. What we want to do is, you know, sort of bring that as a case study for a lot more game studios to say, hey, you know, just follow this, right? This is working. You know, their game asset marketplace has not fallen more than 60-80% even in the worst crash. They've been there for almost 3-4 years now, right? Just that. And sort of using that as a case study and example to sort of convert these guys out, because there is a new business model that is there. wherein you are not the only seller. You know, you have, it's more collaborative. The value of you are actually trading your market cap and not your assets, like not your, you know, not selling your assets, you're trading your market cap. So the entire idea is, how do you build your market cap? It's now you're dealing with, so the biggest problem is games have been only working for players, and which is completely fine, but they don't understand how traders work. They were always anti-traders. They were always anti, you know, these kind of investors or game miners or game grinders. Like, it's just, they were anti this for a long time. Now suddenly they are a very critical part of this space, because everybody has to do their work, right, to build this market cap. So I think bringing that, there's a lot of unlearning that has to happen. And I've been, trust me, I've been talking to really big companies. Okay, you know, some of the, I can't even name that, really big companies. They generally don't want to change that. So, and though they want to get to Web3, they all they can think about is, hey, now I can sell more of my asset, make it NFT and sell it. So there is more way to sell it. That's how they think. But generally, that's not how it's going to work, right? So, and I get it. A lot of players don't like Web3 games, the you know, OG players, because this is the approach. But I think there's a lot more to that.
It's like being, it's, you know, you were using kind of auto manufacturers a little bit. It's like Tesla being so software oriented, you know, they're just going to keep moving so far out ahead from the rest of the pack because they're just not software oriented. You know, it's not native to their business. And it's the same thing as, like, you can even see it in software today. You know, you're looking at like an Adobe, you know, buying like a Figma. Right. And it's like Figma is just so built for the cloud and built for kind of multiplayer, I guess we could say, where, like, yeah, sure, like Adobe moved to that kind of SaaS model and move it to the cloud. But it's like, try, like, figure out how to, on Photoshop and Illustrator and everything else, like, where are the assets? Where are the things that I work on? And it's like, even the disruption of those companies has now happened 20 years later. Now, to think about, yes, thinking about like a new company adopting, like Nike, I think is a perfect example of saying, like, how can you unlock the network effect of like Nike and the passion and everything else? Like, you know, when you could use a token or use an NFT or use some part of that to just like take the network effect of Nike and just times that by 1,000, right? It's like, it's set up perfectly for something like that. Starbucks rewards, yeah, points, but also like, you now have one thing that could do 10 things and they're just like, eh, we can't figure that out yet. And so it's like, I think you're right, where it's like, it is going to be the new thing that disrupts everything. And then everything will try to replicate that. But, you know, it's very hard. And there's, you know, there's only a few companies that end up living a very long time.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a very, you know, so this was a biggest shocker, right? Like, when we talk about Web3 games in the Web3 space, the best way to grow yourself is to actually adopt other game assets, because, say, for example, there's an asset which is very popular, right? Everybody's trading it, everybody's, you know, buying it and using it. The best way for a new game is to actually create utility for that asset, which in today's world is completely against it, right? How will one company, yeah, use another company's asset? And then I said, hey, this is the collaborative world. This is how suddenly those people who own those assets will start playing your game, because, you know, they'll say, hey, now there's more utility, and suddenly you have a lot more people to come in, and the whole network effect, the collaboration, that does not go very well with a lot of folks in general, to even for them to digest the fact this is possible. They probably want to do it only within their game ecosystem. But the ones who will do it, and I'm pretty sure this will be, you know, small indie game studios who will be more collaborative, open to sort of accept other games' assets, will have the faster growth and sort of outpace other ones. The network effect is crazy. The capital coming in is crazy. If you just take advantage of it in the right way, you know, you can literally sail with that.
Amazing, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on here. Thank you, everyone in the audience, for listening. And John, as always, my man, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
We will chat with you backstage.